Hello, everybody. Do you love bedtime stories that spark the imagination? Bed Critters is the delightful children's book that brings crazy creatures and sleepy time magic to life. Now available on Amazon. Just search Bed Critters or look for it wherever you buy books. And what is love in the end, Alabaster said, except the irrational desire to put evolutionary competitiveness aside in order to ease someone else's journey through life? Gabrielle Zevin, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. Hello, I'm Kennedy Weibel.
And I'm Rebecca Weibel.
And this is Reading Pop Classics, the podcast where we discuss modern literary classics, popular books, things that are literature that is talked about currently, books that people are actually reading. And today we are discussing Gabrielle Zevin's Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, a book that you've undoubtedly seen on a table in any bookstore you've been to. Rebecca, have you read it before?
Yes. So I actually listened to this. I listened to this as an audiobook probably in the fall of this past year. Reading it was a different experience from listening to it. You and I talked about this offline a little bit. Honestly, I listened to it. I was going through a bad time and I listened to it and I didn't dislike it or anything, but I was not super impressed with it. Just based on, like you said, like this great marketing campaign where it's like, I feel like this is on every best book list. I see it on every bookstore table that I'm going into. And I kept picking this book up and reading the back of it and then putting it down and not like being interested in it. And then when I saw it was like a free audiobook on Spotify, I was like, I guess I'll go ahead and listen to it. And I didn't love it when I listened to it on audio. I did enjoy it more reading it. It was a different experience for me to read it and pick up, I think, maybe on some details and stuff that kind of floated past me the first time.
And when you say this is on best book lists, it's not just on like best of the year lists. This is showing up on like best books of the century lists.
Yeah, this is listed in lists that include My Brilliant Friend.
Yeah. This is like one of the best books that has come out since the new century flipped over. This is one, we've talked about this before. This is one that people stopped me in public when I was carrying it around and had to tell me how much they loved it. A flight attendant on a flight I was on saw me with it and was like, I had my finger in it. And she's like, did you just start that? And I was like, I did. I started out in the waiting for this plane. She's like, it's incredible. It's so deeply moving. It's like the best book I've ever read. When we were putting it up on Instagram, like putting out the books that were coming up, people were writing into me and being like, it's an incredible book. It's absolutely fabulous. The Goodreads reviews, when I go through them, are just fawning reviews. And I liked it.
I liked it, but this is not going to be a podcast where I fawn over this book. And that is not to say that I don't think it's good or any of that. But My Brilliant Friend gets this sort of similar like accolades and stuff. And we did have a podcast where we fawned over that. We both agreed that this book has a very well-deserved place in best books of the century and top books and books you must read. And this really did not feel like that to me, but I think that maybe some of where that comes from, there are a lot of like hot topic issues in this book.
There's hot topic issues. I, like you, I was not quite folded up and blown away by it like most people who have read it seem to be. And when I first read it, I had this little bit of pushback, like you mentioned, where I was like, why this? What's special about this? I'll say that I've thought about it a lot more. It grew on me as time went on, like after I finished it. And I think also a little bit of my initial, what's so great about this? I think a little bit of that was on me. Usually when I hear people dying over some book, it turns out to be, I don't know, The Nightingale, right? It turns out to be Where the Crawdads Sing, something that it has broad popularity because it is easily digestible and a simple story, well told kind of thing, right?
And this is literary fiction, which does not tend to blow up in the same capacity.
It used to. I feel like when I was younger, books like this were more of a topic of conversation. I think a little bit of my pushback was just that I've gotten used to this kind of book not being widely discussed, not being widely heralded. Toni Morrison novels used to come out and be a cultural bombshell. Jonathan Franzen would write a book, it was a cultural bombshell. And I think it just hasn't happened in a while. So I think more than anything, I was just startled that this made it through. I'm like happy that it did. I liked it. I'm glad that it's as popular as it is, even if it wasn't one that like hit me with the emotional impact that it seems to have hit other people. A friend of mine was telling me when I was talking with her about it, she was like, did you like it? And I was like, yeah, I liked it. And she's like, oh, I'd read it again, except I was crying through 90% of it. And I did not have that reaction. I have a little darker reading, I think, on it than maybe some people do, but I'm glad people liked it. I'm glad a book like this is something that everyone's talking about.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of that, like Sally Rooney falls into that category too. Like these are literary works and people really love them. She pulls in that broader audience that we might have for something like Nightingale or Where the Crawdads Sing.
But like Sally Rooney
or
books,
like the Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, Da Vinci Code is one that like that's something that usually when a book is as popular as this one is, I'm expecting the Da Vinci Code. Sally Rooney is one though people will tell you how much they don't get it. Like you will talk to as many people who are like these books are disgusting as you with all people who love them. I think they're a little bit more.
That's true. When I listened to it, I remember it ending and just being like, all right, I don't really understand what the big I didn't think it was bad. I didn't think it wasn't good or any of that. But I was left with a like, oh, I don't fully understand why this is so popular.
I think part of it is that it's not sentimental. I think people enjoyed the fact that it is not a super sappy book.
That's true. This time when I was reading it, I did have this experience almost immediately, actually, when I was reading it of just, oh, I really missed some stuff. When I listen to this, first of all, I always lose a little bit in listening to audiobooks. We've talked about that. That is not my best way. Yeah, that is not my best way to take in books. And I have actually switched to when I do listen to audiobooks, I try to do more something that would be like, that's not literary fiction, right? More something that would just be like a little bit, something that would be like a fast, quick read for me. That's like, well, whatever. It's like a free audiobook and it'll entertain me while I'm like driving around. Or something that's nonfiction. That tends to be a little better for me to listen to.
Let's get something out in the air. I think the ending is bad. I think it's totally acceptable and a normal reaction to read the end of this book and be like, what the hell? I don't have a ton of critiques for this. I legitimately think the ending is bad. I think it is a bad ending. I think it is a forgivable bad ending, but I think I didn't enjoy how the book wrapped up.
I didn't love how the book wrapped up. I also think this book suffers from being a little bit too long. I think the period after Marx is killed is a little too long.
And that's like the emotional bombshell in the book. And then it goes on to this sort of unsatisfying, I don't know, it's piddling ending that dribbles out and then it just stops.
Yeah. Like if you're dropping this big bomb on us and then, yeah, and then it piddles. That part after it goes on a little bit too long. The ending. And I think I also feel like some of those like hot button issues, the gay marriage and the shooting and the bigotry.
They feel shoehorned into this.
It's like you were writing a book about these three people and their video games. And then you were like, yo, what if I made this political so that it'll end up on all of the front tables?
It feels like this, I don't know, last 5 years, hot button issues transported back in time. They don't feel natural in the story. And it takes you, I don't know, it took me out of it a little bit when I read them, where I was just, wait, isn't this taking place in like.
And it feels to me a little bit, that's what people are responding to when they're like, oh my God, isn't this a great book? It's because it has these issues in it.
No,
but I don't feel like that's what the book is about. So it's, that to me is where it's a little, I'm not surprised that everybody's like, oh my God, it's so good. And it's on the front table at every bookstore. It's like, yeah, of course it is. It's sexy. We got murder. We got. Somebody comes in and shoots up a building. We have somebody's angry about gay marriage. Oh, yeah. Like this is going to, we got to put this on the table because people feel passionate about those things. I feel passionate about those things. Right. Like,
about those things. They're just all of a sudden they happen. And then the book goes on.
This book is about two unlikable people and one likable person who's murdered.
I'm glad you said that because one of the things I think that the unlikability, I think the fact that Sam and Sadie are both slightly unlikable people is part of what I think people like about it. I think some of what people are responding to is that this book does not pander to them emotionally. Sadie is a flawed character and she's just allowed to be flawed. There's no apology for it. She doesn't learn how to be a different person in the end. Sam is a flawed person and he's just allowed to be flawed. He doesn't come to some conclusion at the end. It doesn't.
He has a little more character growth. He has character growth and Sadie really has less of that, in my opinion. He has a little bit more. He has a little bit of growth.
But he doesn't become a different person in the end. He doesn't learn a lesson.
No, he doesn't.
I think what people are responding to some extent might just be the Gen X of it. This is a very Gen X book.
Correct.
Like it does not dwell on anybody's traumas. It doesn't solve anybody's traumas. And it doesn't resolve them in a way that we maybe morally want to be resolved. Dove or Dove, I'm not exactly sure how we're supposed to pronounce that.
It's Dove, and I only know that because of the audiobook.
Okay, Dove's character is a great example of this. Like, he does not get vilified. Like, it's an adult book. And I think people maybe didn't realize quite how thirsty they were for an adult book that isn't just a YA book dressed up for adults, which I think is pretty common in bestseller lists. And
it's certainly Where the Crawdads Sing is that, right? That's an adult book that's dressed up. It's very YA. It's very YA throughout the love story and stuff.
It's a YA book dressed up for adults. And it's
no, and this is not. And we don't listen, is Dove a good boyfriend? He's not.
No, but
does he help them out with? But yeah, but he's not. Is he a good boyfriend? No, he's not. Is he this horrible man that's like a villain in the book? Like, no, he's not. He helps them. He's the reason their initial game does what it does. And he's helped them. And he continues to like care for Sadie and try to have a relationship with her and give her.
Sadie's reacting to him as an adult. She has made choices around her relationship with him that she is okay with. She's given agency in that way where her character doesn't like wallow about it for the rest of her life. She moves on and she keeps him in her life. And I think a lot of books, everything would have turned on that relationship and her like overcoming it and Dove getting his comeuppance and all these things. And this takes a far more realistic approach to it. And I don't know, they're having lunch at the end. Let's start with the plot. You want to start at the beginning?
Yes, I was going to say, at this point, we should get into the plot.
All right. So we open with Sam Masser, who will later become Mazer. We are told in this opening thing that he will change his name to Mazer. The time jumps back and forth a lot in this. We're given like future, what is it? It's not quite a close third because we are told things about the future of the characters, even in the time when we are hearing about their present.
There's a lot of time jumping in this book for sure. I do enjoy that style of writing. I do like when we go back and forth in time to explain what's going on and to fill in the story. I think that's a clever way of writing than something just being like linear.
So it lets us know that we're exploring character and decisions versus like just a plot that we're waiting to have resolved.
Yes.
So we open with Sam Mazer in the Harvard Square train station where there is a magic eye poster on the wall. And while he is trying to fight his way out of there, he sees Sadie Green, a girl from his childhood. And we get a little quick thing of their background just on their science genius gifted kid kind of stuff, how they knew each other in the past. Sadie Green goes to MIT and he calls out to her in the Oregon Trail language of Sadie Green, you have died of dysentery. And they chat briefly in this train station. Sadie gives Sam a game that she has designed and Sam takes it home and plays it with his roommate, Marks.
Yes. And the one quick thing I want to point out about the beginning, it's page 9 in my copy. So the title of the book obviously is Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. That's from Shakespeare, but she uses that like tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow several times in the book. Our first example of that is when he's trying to get Sadie to stay and talk to him. And she's like, oh, my train. And like another train comes and she says, oh, that's my train again. She's already missed one train to talk to him. And Sam says, that's how trains work. And she says, it's true. There's a train and a train and a train. And, and she uses that. She uses it a couple times throughout the book that she picks up on that same pattern of language.
That's a good catch.
I think that's a clever little nod to the title.
I think she's a good writer. So we get this little meeting of these two. We learn that they've known each other in the past. They now go to college near each other. So then we flash back to the day that Sadie and Sam meet. Sadie's sister Alice has leukemia.
She's not terminal, but it is certainly a stressful, horrible thing for a family to go through. And I use the word family because illnesses like this do not only happen to the patient. That's something that affects everybody, particularly any other siblings.
when we meet them, Sadie's gotten kicked out of her sister Alice's hospital room because they've gotten in a fight. And she finds a young boy in a sort of game room. He's playing Nintendo, I think. And being a kid, she just goes, okay, video games, and wanders in and starts talking to this little boy. And they talk about, but they're playing Mario, I think. And so they play games for a while, and then she goes back to her sister's room and they make up and so forth. But it turns out that Sadie is the first person that Sam has spoken to, the first time he has spoken since he was in a car accident that killed his mother and like basically destroyed his foot, like yes. smashed his foot up real bad. So the people at the hospital are like, "You, like, this kid's not been doing okay. We don't know why he talked to you. We don't know what it was, but we would love it if you came back." And Sadie's mother suggests to her that she uses this for the charity work that she needs to do for her bat mitzvah that is coming up. And Sadie agrees. What a great idea. So she starts visiting Sam and hanging out with him and visiting him in the hospital and playing video games with her. And one day when her grandmother is dropping her off, her grandmother says that Sadie should maybe let Sam know that she's marking down this time every time she comes in. That if Sam finds out that she is visiting him for charity, he's going to be hurt. Like, he thinks that she's his friend and it's going to really hurt his feelings if he finds out. And Sadie decides not to tell him and does it.
Well, and Sadie, she does legitimately see him as a friend. And she sees it as a little bit of a game, like how many hours she can get, how many points she can get.
And Sadie makes a decision that is larger than just continuing to do it, though, because it's a game. Like, she finishes her 20 hours and keeps clocking them. And she makes a decision not to tell Sam about it.
Yes, which is a flawed decision.
Yes. She gets 609 hours out of this. She only needs 20. And she gets a special prize for it.
But she's getting a lot of praise for from her parents at the synagogue. And then, yeah, she gets the prize.
It's a video game corollary. She gets a high score.
Mm-hmm. I do have one thing I wanted to point out from this scene from when she and Sam meet for the first time. This just called back for me when we were talking about My Brilliant Friend. And we were talking about how it starts when these girls are very, very young. And their entire worldview is the building that they live in and the little courtyard.
Yeah.
And then it expands out to the rest of Naples as they get older. So just something that caught my eye in this scene when the two of them are making friends. They both live in LA, so they have a conversation. Sam's talking about his grandparents' house of pizza, Dong and Bong's New York style house of pizza, which I love.
Great name.
I love that too. And I like that he says Dong and Bong are my grandparents' names. It's not even funny in Korean. It's like being called Jack and Jill. But anyways, he goes on from there. He says the restaurant is on Wilshire in K-Town. And Sadie says, "What's K-Town? Lady, are you even from Los Angeles? K-Town is Koreatown. How do you not know that? Everybody knows K-Town. I know what Koreatown is. I didn't know people called it K-Town. Where do you live anyway?" Sam asked. "The flats." "What are the flats?" "It's the flat part of Beverly Hills," Sadie said. "It's pretty close to K-Town. See, you didn't know what the flats were. People in LA only ever know about the part of town that they live in. For one, that is true about cities, like bigger cities like that, that people are like only familiar with where they live.
LA is also enormous.
LA is sprawling. But we did talk about that, like that small worldview of kids. So they don't know about each other's like worlds yet because they're not from the same part
of
LA.
But this tells us, the reader, it sets up the like two sides of the track. We do get from this part that Sadie enjoys her time with Sam. She does not feel like this is put upon her. She likes hanging out with him and talking about video games. She likes meeting someone who is also as interested in them as she is.
Because she doesn't have a lot of friends. Her home life is tough at the moment, right? Again, she's the kid that isn't sick, so she's getting less attention. She talks about how her parents don't always feed her.
Yeah.
They forget about her and stuff. Sam is going through a worse time, but she also needs Sam. She also needs a friend. She also needs somebody who pays a little bit of attention and cares about her.
So we jump into the future, back into our present, I suppose. Again, Sadie at MIT is in a game design and development class with a professor named Dove, who is like a tech bro archetype. He's like a charismatic douchebag game bro who has designed a really popular game called something I did not write down.
I think it's called Dead Sea.
Dead Sea. Yes, you are correct. So he runs a class, and in every class, he divides it up almost like a writing workshop. She creates the game that she gave to Sam in our opening scene called Solution, which the idea came from her grandmother. And it's a game where you work in a factory, and at each little level, you're given the choice to like get more information about the factory or to take points and move on to the next task. And almost everybody just takes the points and moves on to the next task. And then at the end of the game, you find out that the factory that you've been working in and doing super well in is a German World War II concentration camp factory that is killing the Jews and everybody else who was put to death by the Germans. And Dove likes it. One girl in her class gets super offended. It turns out people don't like being tricked into being Nazi collaborators. One girl gets offended and she complains to Dove, and Dove talks her down from like filing a complaint with the school. And Dove goes to talk to Sadie about how he talked to her about it. And he asks her out, like, come have lunch with me. And Sadie goes, and then he brings her back to his place and they hook up and they begin a romance, her professor and her, after she designs this game. And 4 months into that relationship, she finds out he's married. He is separated, right?
He is separated. That's why he's in. He's Israel.
His wife doesn't live with him at any rate. She lives back in Israel.
They're having problems. That's why he's taken the job at MIT. So they are separated. So they are separated, but he is married. And she does not obviously love that.
No. And he's preying on students, or preying on one student at any rate.
Yeah.
She's young. She's 19, I think, when this is going on.
19,
maybe about to turn 20. So she spends the summer with him, and she takes an internship over that summer at a video game company called Cellar Door. And I have a little quote here from her time at Cellar Door that goes, "It perhaps goes without saying that Sadie hadn't only been protecting Dove when she didn't reveal to her colleagues at Cellar Door who her boyfriend was. She had also been protecting herself. There were even fewer women in professional games than there were at MIT, and Sadie didn't want to hobble herself before she'd begun her career. It was unfair, but attractive young women who had reputations for sleeping with powerful men acquired professional baggage. They sometimes found they had a difficult time being taken seriously when they moved on from those men." So over winter break, Dove goes back to Israel to see his son and his estranged wife. And then we flash back to Sam finding out from Sadie's sister, Alice, in just the kind of snippy, snipey thing that an older sister says. Alice sees Sam at the hospital and says something like, he for a second mistakes her for Sadie because they look alike, like he sees her from the back or something. And she goes, no, if I was Sadie, I'd have a clipboard marking my time with you, or something shitty like that she says. And that's how Sam finds out that Sadie has been using him for her charity work for her bat mitzvah. So he calls her and confronts her. She apologizes. He does not accept the apology. And then in a kind of incredible part of the book, but it gives us an idea of who these people are and how they think of themselves, Frida, her grandmother, because Sadie is upset, takes her out to lunch in Beverly Hills and tells her, there are people like you and like me. We have bad things happen to us and we survive them. This is insane because her grandmother is talking about surviving the Holocaust.
Yeah. Well, she does actually say that's nothing like what you've survived. Even as a child, she's like, yeah, well, I mean, you know, you survived the Holocaust and I'm over here surviving.
I had to go back and reread it. Maybe that is the kind of thing that a Holocaust survivor would say to their beloved granddaughter. But it struck me as an incredibly false equivalency. The thing that Sadie is going through, which is suffering the consequences of her actions, and the thing that Frida went through, which is like a horrible historical genocide.
And then, so here's something else. Sadie can't handle shit. Anytime something bad happens to Sadie, she gets in bed for weeks at a time and doesn't do her work and doesn't go to school and doesn't talk to people.
Yeah, she does go down pretty easy.
We all handle things differently. I'm just saying, Frida's incorrect. Sadie doesn't handle things well at all.
No. Frida's talking to her granddaughter and trying to make her feel better.
She's talking to her granddaughter and making her feel better. And then it says, but with people like your friend, you must be exceptionally gentle or they may break. Sam goes through far more than Sadie ever does.
Oh, yeah.
Sam is a far stronger person. Sam just continues to walk around on that bad foot and pretend everything is fine all of the time. Like, it takes Sam a little bit of doing to, like, eventually even admit that he needs help to deal with surgery on his foot and stuff, which, I mean, we'll get to and we'll talk about later. But I'm just noticing that this is incorrect in Frida. The person who needs to be handled gently or is going to break is Sadie. And the person who survives bad things happening to him is Sam, who's had bad things happening to him for his whole life. Before we continue, one thing I wanted to say, I did also have the same quote about Sadie and her at her summer internship. There is a line at the end of that paragraph is, as much in love as she was with Dobe, she was already imagining a future that didn't have him in it.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting because he does stick with her for the rest of the book. And it's like a huge part of her work life. And then something that does get addressed, MIT is not filled with women in general. And so they do talk about that a little bit. She does talk about how people sometimes have this impression of like, oh, you know, it was easier for you to get into MIT because you're a woman and like they have to meet that quota. Like she bumps up against that. But she's got like some thoughts on that. And it's just like, no, I'm really smart and I worked really hard to be here. And like I proved myself in my classes. It's something I will say that I do like about Sadie is that she does not seem to dwell on that a ton. Like she acknowledges it that she's because she spends her whole life in a sort of misogynistic field. Because it's mentioned that it's like the guys in the school look at the women that are there of like, nah, yeah, I mean, there's some guys that didn't get in because you're here.
Yes.
And she's just kind of like, eh, fuck that. I'm super smart and like really good at what I do. And she just lets that show through like her work. And I really like that about Sadie. And I like that she makes Sadie that character instead of someone who constantly has to like rail against it. It comes up some, and it should. It should come up in the book because it's like to pretend that she's not in this masculine world and that there aren't going to be some feelings and thoughts on that is wrong.
I don't like everything Sadie does in this book, but I do like her as a character. And I like that she is a, I like that she's doesn't do the right thing all the time. It's an actual character trait. It quoted, she was already imagining a future without Dove in it. I think this like first interaction with Dove echoes the interaction that we heard about with Sam. Like that 609 hours, I think she just realistically is imagining a future without Sam in it. Like, look, this is what I'm doing right now. Like, what am I going to know Sam in 20 years? Like, she's not imagining that, right?
Oh, yeah. No, that's a good point.
Like, this is a thing that I'm doing now. I'm going to go to college. Like, I'm not going to have this kid in my life for my whole life. Like, it's fine. It's fine. I'm imagining a future that doesn't have Sam in it. I'm getting my bat mitzvah hours and it's cellar door. She's imagining a future without Dove in it.
So Hannah is like the other girl that's in her video game class. And she's the one that has the problem with Solution that she's offended in the end when she has been called a Nazi after she's played the game.
Yes, I believe she's also Jewish. And that's part of the reason that she takes extra offense at it.
Hannah Levin is the only girl in the seminar besides Sadie, though this was an ordinary male to female ratio, class ratio at MIT. But so Sadie goes up to her after class to talk to her, I think just to set up that like, oh, we're both girls in here and there's not a lot of us. And to set up a little bit of like camaraderie, which is nice. But Hannah has the opposite feeling. If Sadie's very much unbothered by like, I'm fine, there's not a lot of other girls here. And like, I don't care if other people think I don't belong here because like, I know I do. Hannah's probably the opposite of that because she goes up and tries to talk to Hannah and introduce herself. And ask her if she's played Dead Sea, because that's Dove's game, and she's not ever even heard of it. Sadie's trying to connect with her, like, about video games, and she's not having it. And Sadie's, the thought process, Sadie didn't know why she bothered. You would think women would want to stick together when there weren't that many of them, but they never did. It was as if being a woman was a disease that you didn't wish to catch. As long as you didn't associate with the other women, you could imply to the majority, the men, I'm not like those other ones. I thought it was just like that interesting comparison. I do think in those fields, I've heard other women friends of mine that are like in STEM and stuff where there is a very like male component to what they do. I've heard them talk about that there are those women that are just sort of like, no, I don't want to be female by association.
Well, I don't want to be in the girls group, right?
I don't want to be in the girls group instead of just like owning the fact that it's like, I've earned my place here and I don't really care. I thought that was like an interesting interaction because Sadie does not have a ton of female interaction in the book. We don't see her with other females. We see her with Dove. We see her with Marks. We see her with Sam. Marks's girlfriend is Zoe, I think, is her friend for a little while, but we don't really see her interacting with women very much.
She spends most of the book in the company of men. It's a guy-heavy book.
Another part of the reason I wanted to bring this up is we talk about how a little later on, when we want to build up to like the shooting and how we lose Marks, it's like that stuff does feel a little shoehorned in. This is one of those social issues that does feel like it actually has a place in the book. Whereas, like we discussed, some of those other things, like you said, they're a little bit anachronistic and they just feel like they're in there to get this book on the shelves, on the table at bookstores.
Yeah. And when I say anachronistic, like the way they're talked about is like the way we talk about them now. While they were issues back then, it's the particular language around them and the way they're treated in the book feels transplanted from today into a past where I'm not entirely sure that's how they would have come up.
Right.
Maybe these people were in California, though, a little more progressive. So we jump back to our regular timeline. Dov comes back from Israel and announces that he and his wife are going to try and make it work. So he breaks up with Sadie. Then we cut over to Sam. That's how that section ends. So after winter break, Sam is trying to get in touch with Sadie about her video game. Him and his roommate, Marks, have played the game. They thought it was really interesting. They thought it was like a really like cool concept. They thought it was designed well. And Sam can't raise her. Like he can't find Sadie. He goes through some steps and finds out where she lives.
I think he goes to the school directory or something, maybe.
He goes to the school directory and finds her, and he shows up at her apartment and finds her all sleepy and depressed about, we the reader assume, Dov. Like she's in bed. She's not getting out of bed. She's kind of rude to him and dismissive and is just like, get out of here, Sam. Leave me alone. I don't know what you want. He sees a maze of Los Angeles that he made for her framed on the wall. So he hangs out for a few minutes and he leaves and he steals another game that she has just laying on her desk. He takes a copy of a game that she made called Emily Blaster. So then we flash back again to a month after Sam finds out that he is Sadie's charity case back when they were kids. She has invited him to the bat mitzvah. This is the part that I think is a little bit cruel. I don't think it's nice that she didn't say anything about the, like, she was clocking her time with him for 609 hours of charity. That's not nice. The kicker is that she invites him to the bat mitzvah where she will get a special award for having done that in front of him and in front of all of her friends.
Oh, that's a good point.
I think that is cruel. I don't know that Sadie is being thoughtless about it.
She invite him?
Yeah, she wants to make friends again. She wants him to... She wrote him a couple of things. She has made genuine overtures to, like, apologizing. But again, the thoughtlessness of just, like, she invites him to the bat mitzvah and, like, you're going to be presented with an award. He's going to be sitting in the room when they're, like, 609 hours volunteering with some poor soul at the hospital. And it's going to be him with his hurt foot in the room when you get that award.
Right. It's going to be him with the obvious injury.
That's a kicker of the poor decision that she makes as a child, to be fair. But that's the, like, the extra little bit of cruelty. He does not want to go. His grandmother returns the RSVP anyway and frames this map of LA. He used to make mazes for her, and he made this big maze of Los Angeles showing the way. The maze was between her house and his house from the flats to K-Town. He didn't give it to her after he found out that he was her charity case. His grandmother frames the map of LA to give her as a gift. And Sam is upset and he's horrified and he refuses to go. And his grandfather, Dong, takes the gift and drops it off. And in the end does not make Sam go to the bat mitzvah. But so that's why we know what the map of LA that Sam saw in her room when she's all sleepy and depressed and won't get up, seeing that above her desk framed and hanging on her wall, he realizes that she kept it all these years. She brought it with her to MIT. She's got it in her room. And that's a little bit of what drives Sam to not just go away like she's asked. He goes back to his friend Marks and asks him what he should do. So Sam and Marks play Emily Blaster. The game's a shooting game, not a shooting game like Wolfenstein or Doom or something like that, but you have a little like asteroids. You have a little blaster and you have to shoot lines from Emily Dickinson's poetry as they fall down the screen, and you have to shoot them in the correct order of the poem, which is pretty clever.
Which is clever. I know. Her games are good.
But it leads to what I think is probably the funniest line in the book, which is when Mark says, this is the most violent poetry game I've ever played.
Yeah, I like that too.
And in this scene, we learn a little bit about Marks and Sam. So Marks takes care of Sam. He got roomed with this kid, realized that like he's not good at taking care of himself, not super outgoing, probably not mentally doing great. And Marks is a completely unrealistic person, I will say, but
yeah,
unbelievably kind. But he takes it upon himself, like when Sam didn't have sheets for his bed, he just gives him an extra set of his sheets. Marks calls Sam's grandparents when Sam doesn't reach out to them and gives them updates and lets them know that he's okay. And when Marks decides to live off campus,
he decides to live off campus because Sam's having a hard time in the dorms.
That's correct.
He does not decide to live off campus. I mean, he does, but he does it for Sam.
Yes.
And makes Sam think like, oh, just like we're friends, so I'd like you to come with me.
Yes. He's an incredibly generous and kind soul, and he stays that way throughout the book. So he takes Sam with him to live off campus. And so Sam asks him, he tells him a little bit about Sadie and asks him what he should do. And Marks tells him to keep going over there, be a good friend, and just always bring something. A little bit of food, water, a little gift, like just bring things and keep showing up. And that's kind of all you can do is just keep showing up. So Sam keeps going over. Sadie keeps telling him not to. She asks why he keeps showing up. And Sam doesn't say this out loud because he's not a person who says things like this out loud. But he thinks to himself, because you're my oldest friend. Because once when I was at my lowest, you saved me. Because I might have died without you. Which is very sweet. I don't know, the oldest friend thing. He hated her after this. But he remembers that he wasn't talking, that he wasn't doing okay. And that without her showing up, he just wouldn't have made it.
I think this is a nice time for me to point something out. They don't have other friends.
They don't.
They're not people that have friends. It's pointed out somewhere in here that Sadie didn't have a lot of friends when she met Sam. Sam didn't have any friends when he met Sadie. These aren't people that have very many friends. Sam has Marks because Marks has kind of adopted him and they become good friends and they're a set. Sadie doesn't have anybody. Sadie's got Dove, who's not a friend. He's a boyfriend, sure. And that is not the same thing. Sam has so few friends that when one of his friends is sad, he has to ask the only other friend he has to be like, what do you do when somebody's sad?
I think it's just as you're reading it, though, like literally a page before, he hated her and she was unforgiven. And then smash cut to like, you're my oldest friend. I would have died without you. And this is throughout. There's not even a couple of lines of like internal reflection on Sam's part about this. There's the part that's quoted and that's it. That's what you got to go on. But let's assume that he means it. The book wants us to assume that he means it. I just think it's weird that like they don't ever reflect on any of these things. Not for pages, but I don't know, a couple lines of like internal character thought that maybe address the like, you know what, I was like deeply, deeply hurt by her, but like I do realize that I wouldn't have made it out of this without her. But the book never gives us that, which is interesting. Like it consistently doesn't give us that from anybody. I think it's a little bit of a consistent narrative issue for me throughout the book. In the same part, when Sam we're learning about the past, we get the image of his grandfather Dong in the Harvard shirt that he wears, that he wears it like almost every day in the pizza place. And he wears it so much it's full of holes because he's so proud of Sam.
Right.
Which is an incredibly sweet image.
I like that.
So on day 12 of Sam's vigil, Sadie is not there when he goes over to see her because she went to medical, which is what Marks and Sam both hoped would happen, that she would like come to it on her own. She starts feeling better and taking care of herself. And she is grateful to Sam for what he has done, like coming over and helping give her at least one regular thing to look forward to. And she says to him, promise me we won't ever do this again. Promise me that no matter what happens, no matter what dumb thing we supposedly perpetrate on each other, we won't ever go 6 years without talking to each other. Promise me you'll always forgive me and I promise I'll always forgive you. And then the narration says, these, of course, are the kinds of vows young people feel comfortable making when they have no idea what life has in store for them. I had two little kind of issues with this. One, I don't know what the like supposedly perpetrate on one another she's going on about. She totally did the thing that Sam was upset about. Sam has not perpetrated anything on her at this point in the book.
At this point, no. But I will say that like should his feelings be hurt? Yes. But he doesn't speak to her for 6 years. He won't speak to her ever. He calls her a cunt. He won't speak to her. He doesn't speak to her again for years. She reached out multiple, several times with apologies and he wouldn't speak to her. He wouldn't acknowledge any of it.
Sam was in the most fragile emotional state he would probably ever be in his entire life. His mother was just killed. His foot was just badly, badly maimed. And from his point of view, someone pretended to be his friend so that she could get 609 hours at a bat mitzvah.
Which, like, is fair. If I was 12 years old and somebody did that to me, I would feel exactly like Sam. I'm not defending it. I'm just saying.
He wasn't simply 12 and going about his day. He was 12 in a hospital, nonverbal, mentally destroyed when this happened to him. I just think it's interesting that she's just like, promise me we won't do this again. Promise me no matter what we perpetrate. Like, the we is bringing Sam in as though he committed some kind of act. I mean, he shouldn't have called her a cunt. That's not nice. But
she kind of had it coming. She deserved it, right? But he never speaks to her again for years and years and years and years. Even with his grandparents are trying to encourage, like, bro, you don't have any other friends. I know this girl hurt your feelings, but she is still trying to be your friend. She was always your friend. Did she do this thing that was painful and deceitful? 100%, and it was the wrong thing to do. But what his grandparents see and are trying to point out to him, and what her grandmother was trying to point out in the beginning, is like, you genuinely like this person and you want to be his friend, but I am with you that this does set up who Sadie is. Something else this sets up is that, like, Sadie later on is the one who is.
Yeah, Sam keeps his promise.
She's the one. Yes, she's the one who's unforgiving later.
Yeah, yes, she is.
For something that isn't Sam's fault.
I think it makes her an interesting character. I have some parts about this I want to talk about later when we get into a little farther into the story.
I had that same quote to bring up. Something that just a couple pages later.
We cut into part two here. So we're going into part two.
We cut into part two. And right in the beginning of part two, there's a quote that I just think goes nicely with that. Like, this promise to forgive each other and stay friends. This is a quote about their friendship. They had the rare kind of friendship that allowed for a great deal of privacy within it. One of the reasons they had become such good friends originally was because she had not insisted that he tell his sad stories to satisfy her own curiosity. And the least he could do was return the favor. And he doesn't. He doesn't ask her what she's depressed about. He doesn't push her for, like, why she's sad. He just continues to show up and be friends with her. But then I think that comes into play later when she feels that he's pushed her back towards Dove and blames him for her adult decision to get back together with Dove.
I want to talk about that too when we get up there. The other thing about this line, what's the line after that? That these, of course, are the kinds of vows young people feel comfortable making when they have no idea what life has in store for them. This happens maybe, I don't know, 8 to 9 times throughout the book where the narration pulls out of the sort of style that it's been in to talk to us, the reader, in this way. And I find it incredibly distracting. This sort of thing, like, the narrator becomes a person talking to us.
Always love that. I don't like those little breaks. It's like Jim looking at us at the camera and shrugging his shoulders on the office or whatever. Mm-hmm.
The problem is for me that the narration doesn't do it consistently. It's not that kind of book. It's just all of a sudden, it's like the author was like, I'll throw in a little aside to the reader here. Anyhow, we get to part two, influences, and it opens with an article about Ichigo, which is the game that Sadie and Sam make that is like their big debut splash. And it's an article about Ichigo in which Sadie tells the story of Sam asking her to glass flowers and it being closed, and asking her to make a game over the summer, and how he asked her that if the game does really well, when she retells the story about them deciding to make a game together, he asks her not to say that Glass Flowers is closed. It's an art exhibit he asked her to. He asked her not to say that Glass Flowers was closed, but she does, and the article part ends with her saying, I'm betraying him.
Oh yeah, it does.
There's a little piece of me, like, Sadie never forgives Sam for not forgiving her, right? Sam's 6 years of silence holds Sadie accountable for a thing that she does not appreciate being held accountable for. And for all the stuff in this book about, we are told by the narration how much they love each other, I don't think these people like each other that much.
I don't think that Sadie particularly likes Sam, and Sam is in love with Sadie from day one.
Yeah. When I mentioned at the top of the episode that I think I read this a little bit darker than some people did, a lot of the reviews and, like, the conversations and stuff that I read around it from other people, not from the author herself, but from other people, were just about the love story and how much they meant to each other and what a great friendship. And I'm just sort of like, is it?
These people are creative partners, and that's not love.
No, I don't think
these people share a passion for video games, and they are good creative partners. And we see that because of the kind of games and stuff that they create together. But they need Marks to be there to balance that out.
Yeah.
None of this would happen without Marks, being there to balance out these two people's. Nothing would ever happen. These people would have never made games if Marks wasn't there. Marks is the love. Marks is the person who is filled with love and caring, and he loves both of these people. They don't love each other.
I think Sam would tell you that he loves Sadie, but I think it's just because he doesn't see a lot of people and doesn't know.
He doesn't have other relationships to compare it to, really.
Maybe he thinks that like the way Sadie treats him is the love he deserves because he doesn't think very highly of himself. But I don't think he really loves her. He just doesn't talk to almost anybody else.
Right. Like this is just the only woman in his life. He has one girlfriend. Yeah. He has one girlfriend that we know about in the book, and that's it. He's otherwise like a lonely guy who hangs out with his grandparents, Marks, and Sadie.
And it's weird when that other girlfriend shows up briefly, just almost as an afterthought in the narration.
Yeah.
So they start brainstorming. All right, so we cut back to our timeline, our regular timeline, and they start brainstorming for their game, the game that we just read an article about from the future. They steal a whiteboard from a classroom on Harvard's campus, and they discuss their creative visions. They go back and forth. They don't know what they want to make. They know what they don't want to make. And we get some good stuff, I think, just as they bat this around. Like, how do you pick an idea for a project that's going to like really move you and keep you going? I like all that stuff. Sadie wants to make art specifically, and Sam wants to make something fun and immersive that removes you from the world. This is their separate points of view. Sadie wants it to be creative and beautiful specifically. Sam has a little bit more eye toward the experience of playing it, right?
Right.
So they go to see Marks in Twelfth Night. You mentioned the train and a train and a train being a callback or being a reference to the Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, the line from Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. I hadn't caught that. But when they go to see Marks, in the student plays at Harvard, they go to see him in Twelfth Night, and the 12th visit from Sam over to Sadie's place is the one where she's not there. She's starting to become okay. So another little reference to Shakespeare there. They go to see Marks in the play Twelfth Night, and Sadie sees the shipwreck in the play and leans over to Sam in the theater and says, "Our game should start with a shipwreck." And Sam whispers back, "Yes, a child is lost at sea." And then over dinner with Marks's dad after the play is when Sadie learns that Marks is going to get a producer credit on the game, and she doesn't like this. They're building it, by the way, in Marks's apartment. After this play, Marks is going to go to, he goes somewhere, an internship someplace or something like that, and he lets them use his like wonderful apartment for the summer to build the game. So then after this, we get a flashback to Anna Lee and Sam when they move out to LA, and Sam goes out to dinner not long after they move back with his father, who will never show up again in the book, but he's a Jewish talent agent. And I mentioned that he is a Jewish talent agent because Sam's mixed heritage is relevant to the story. Sam is Korean on his mother's side and American Jewish on his father's side. So Marks comes back early from his internship to the apartment that he lent to Sadie and Sam for the summer. And because Sadie is kind of not cool, she's mad about this.
Marks
wants to come back to his own apartment. And it's him who names the game Ichigo. They have a little kid that they've designed who's wearing a jersey with a 14 on the back. They're batting this around and trying to think of a name. And he suggests that they could change it to 15 instead of 14. And that the Japanese word for 15 is Ichigo. And notably, foreshadowing, it also means strawberry. Ichigo means 15 and it means strawberry. And later on in the book, when Marks is in a coma and he imagines himself as the bird.
Oh, he's eating the strawberry. He's in the strawberry patch. Strawberry. I forgot about that.
Yeah. Which is nice. Nicely done, Mrs. Seven. So they're working together in the apartment, and Sadie's dealing with her annoyance, both that Marx is going to get a producer credit because he's letting them use his apartment, and her annoyance that Marx is even there in his own apartment. And Marx asks Sam at some point if he would be okay if he asked Sadie out, because Marx can tell that Sam and Sadie are close. He doesn't want to step on any toes. Sam says no, and Marx is okay with that and moves on. They're developing the game, and they're coding it and writing it, and they run into an issue because Sadie cannot make a good enough graphics engine to support what she wants the game to look like. She doesn't have time before school starts again. She can't do it with the time that she has. She could do it. She just can't do it in the available time for them to finish this game. It would take too long. So she gets depressed and goes to bed again. One of the many times Sadie will take to her bed in this novel. So while she's in bed, Sam is like, I'm going to try to help find a solution to this. I'm going to go through all the games that I have and look for what's the style that we kind of want to look like, and what can we take from it? What can we steal from it? Can we copy it? Can we lift it? So Sam finds Dead Sea, Dove's game, in the bottom of a box of Sadie's games while he's going through this exercise of examining all the games to see if they can find something that'll help her. And the little section where this happens ends with Sam just getting to the bottom of the box and picking up Dead Sea. So when Sadie emerges from Marx's room, where she's still living, even though Marx is back in the apartment sleeping on the couch or something, Sam and Dove are playing Dead Sea and are like, this is what we want our game to look like. And she's like, I know the guy that developed this game. His name is Dove, and he developed his own graphics engine for it called Ulysses. And they're like, you should go ask him if we can use that. And she does. And he plays a little bit of the sample of what they have, and he gives it to them. He's like, you're brilliant. This game is going to be great. Dove is happy to let her have Ulysses. He also becomes a producer in exchange for this and an equity partner in the game once it's done. And around this time, Sadie and Sam decide that they're going to take the next semester off to finish this game. So they get the game finished. Marx has an ex-girlfriend, Zoe, who is a music major, and she scores the game for them. And they finish it. And when this happens, because Marx is friends with all of his exes, because we are told that Marx is such a sweet guy and so nice that when he does get tired of dating someone, he's so charming, he makes it seem like it's their idea to break up with him.
Yes. So they don't feel especially hurt by him. Marx is apparently some sort of magic person who everybody loves and no one is ever mad at.
Yeah, he's magical in the way, when we read A Parable of the Sower, I think we commented that, remind me of the main character's name?
Lauren.
That Lauren is like an adult's magical idea of the perfect teenager.
Yeah. He's this perfect person. He always has girlfriends and stuff. He goes through women, but in a way that is somehow not mean. No one considers him like a cad, and they all still like him when they break up, which feels
He doesn't think about them meanly. He seems to have genuine affection for all of them. He is rich. He's incredibly good looking. He's incredibly smart. Everyone in the book is incredibly smart because he does all of the...
Like, we've talked about that he's the glue for this creative team, because they would tear each other apart.
He starts an LLC for them.
If Marx weren't there, but he does all of the logistics. Yeah. Yes, he does all of the business logistics that need to get done and that creatives are notoriously not awesome at. Sorry, creatives, but I hear you say it yourself. Not your cup of tea.
No, he becomes like a project manager on top of being
the producer,
their finance guy and their accountant. And he creates timelines and operational plans for them to develop the work in a way that will be the quickest path to completion. So after Zoe, his ex, scores the game, Marx and Zoe get back together. So one night, right around the time, I think it's the night they finish the game, Sam walks Sadie home back to Dove's. Oh, I forgot to mention, Dove is happy to give Sam, Sadie, and Marx his graphics engine, Ulysses, becomes the equity partner, and him and Sadie start their relationship up again. It didn't work out with his wife, I guess. And Sadie goes back to Dove. So the night they finish the game, Sam walks Sadie home back to Dove's, drops her off. Sadie tells Sam that she loves him, and she means it in like a friendship, meeting of the minds kind of way. Sam can't say it back because he's the kind of person who can't say things like this. What is it that she says? I know that it makes you, she uses a phrase, I know that it makes you truly uncomfortable. And he says, truly. And so then whenever she says, I love you, he just answers back, truly, or something like that. I'm messing it up.
You're messing it up, but I'm not remembering what it is either. And we're going to have to come across it in the quotes.
Anyhow, he drops her off at Dove's.
But, and as he's whatever it is, it is a shorthand way of him basically saying, I love you too, that is satisfying for both of them and doesn't force him into something that makes him uncomfortable, which is sweet.
Yes. I want to say that I think at this point in their relationship, they're like on a high from this game. And this is the only time in the entirety of the novel, beside that like little flashback where they're playing games for a while, which is like four paragraphs, that they like one another.
Yeah, I agree with
this
that.
This point right here. This is it. As he is leaving after she goes into Dove's apartment building, he falls on the ice. And that's where the scene ends. And then we flash back again to Sam and his mother, Anna Lee, when they lived in New York City before they moved back to LA. They're walking around one night. They'd gone to see some play. Sam's mother, Anna, was an actress, and her agent got them tickets to something that she took Sam to that she normally wouldn't have gone to, but she thought Sam would like it. And he did. And when they're walking home from the theater, a woman jumps out of a window to commit suicide, almost hits them, and lands on the sidewalk in front of them. There is an utterly implausible conversation that takes place here between Sam's mother and Anna Lee.
Yeah, this woman's neck is broken. She wouldn't be speaking. She's bleeding out. She's not having a conversation with anybody.
Sam's mother, Anna, sends Sam into a bodega to tell them to call an ambulance and stay inside there because she doesn't want him to see the gore and everything. But then she has this long, implausible conversation where it turns out the woman's name is also Anna Lee. They talk about this for a minute. We're kind of a long time considering the circumstances. She has this whole conversation with her. She's splattered on the ground. They have the same name. And then the woman dies and she goes in and finds Sam playing Donkey Kong in the back of this bodega. And that's why they move back to LA. She's just like, I don't want to be in the city anymore. I don't want my son to see things like this. We're going back to Bong and Dong's. Her parents. Okay, so that's why they move back to LA. We go back to our regular timeline where Marks and Sadie are aware that Sam is missing and they're talking about what to do about this.
Have we talked about them selling the game yet?
No, we haven't gotten there yet. They've just finished the game.
They've just finished the game. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Sam falls on the ice. We have the flashback to Anna Lee and the improbable conversation.
Yeah, that's a weird thing. That to me feels like a thing they could have lifted out of the book and I wouldn't have been like, oh no.
I'm also not entirely sure what the like fact that the woman's name is also Anna Lee. I guess it like spooks the mother whose name is also Anna Lee.
There were some things like that in this book that stuck out and being like, I feel like that didn't need to be there. And that's one of them.
Yeah. So we go back to our regular timeline where Sam is missing. Sadie and Marks talk about it. And they're like, he's private. He's like this. He goes dark for a little while. And it's also the 90s where that means something different. It's not like he's not answering text messages. Like just if he's not answering the phone here, if you're out, you're just out and people can't find you. She tells Dove that she's worried about it. And he says to her, once you have children, you'll never be able to worry about a friend the same way. And he makes the comment. He's like, oh, I forget you're young. You still think of your friends as family. Once you have children, you'll never be able to worry about a friend the same way.
Yeah.
We haven't really talked a lot about Dove's character, but he is like a very classic condescending older guy in some ways.
100%.
Sadie hears this and rolls her eyes. I will say, though, having children, that line is completely true. Once you have children, you'll never worry about a friend the same way. Your comparison point evaporates. It's like you would think once you survive the Holocaust, you would never say that someone else who just did something mean to a friend survives things the same way you survive things. I marked it because it's, I think, a very accurate line. But it turns out Sam has been in the hospital because he is like when he fell, his foot went out again. He's constantly got problems with his foot. They eventually find him in the hospital. I think he calls someone. And finally, after he goes through all of the stuff of getting checked in and everything, he calls someone and tells them. And he tells them not to come see him, but they do anyway. And they bring champagne and they celebrate finishing the game. And it's a very sweet scene. Okay. Then we cut from that very sweet scene to, I don't know, a couple pages of Dove making Sadie do S&M stuff. making, maybe in quotes, the book takes pains to let us know that it is all very consensual. Sadie just doesn't particularly care for it, but that is, we are told over and over again that it is all very consensual.
Right.
He also loves Ichigo. So I don't know, that's in there. So
yeah, that again. So that I feel like is a little bit one of those things. It's like, oh, let me put some like Hot Topic thing in here. Let me put this 50 Shades of Grey reference in here. But
I think
it's give us this other reason to dislike Dove.
I think it's to show us another crummy part of the relationship, that like Sadie is going along with all of this like weird stuff that he's into, that she's clearly not, that she's playing along with because it's a thing for him. And yeah, it seems like it just adds a salacious way to show us that it's not a great relationship.
Yeah, maybe, that's a great way to say it, that it is. It's this like thing that's kind of salacious. It's a reason for us to dislike Dove a little bit. But she makes the decision to get back together with him. He's not like, oh, you have to be my girlfriend again, or I'm not going to let you use Ulysses. He lets her use Ulysses. She could keep that professional. We've just had the quote we talked about a little while ago. When she was an intern at Cellar Door, she kept her relationship with him private because she already sees, like, I want to move away from this man at some point professionally. I don't want to be linked to him. And then when you go to him to use his engine, his game engine, it's like she ends up back with him.
He seems to have a little bit of power over her. And I think this is something else in there to highlight it, that like she's doing a lot of things she doesn't actually want to do for this guy, like getting back together with him. Like he seems to have a little power over her, and she seems to be slightly addicted to him. And for all of the standing up for herself she does in other ways, she can't do it with Dove. And it highlights, I guess, just the like the inequality of that relationship, right? The like imbalance of power between him being her professor, incredibly accomplished and well-regarded in the field she wants to be in. But reading it, it just comes out of left field and then ends.
Yeah.
Marks, Sam, Sadie start a company that they call Unfair Games. And they are launching Ichigo to the world at large. There's two different companies that want to put the game out for them. One of them is Cellar Door, where Sadie had her uneventful internship, and a larger one called Opus. Sadie wants to go with Cellar Door because they have a couple of things that she really likes. They will not require them to make a sequel, and she does not want to make a sequel. They don't really want to change anything about the game. Opus wants in the contract that they will make a sequel within, I don't know, a year or something like that. They also want to make the character of Ichigo a boy.
Yes, something we haven't talked about is that previously Ichigo has been meant to be a non-binary character that Sam and Sadie are referring to as they, them.
Yes.
And they don't make it either a little boy or a little girl. And the only piece of clothing that Ichigo wears is the long jersey.
Yes. And to be clear, not non-binary in the sense that somebody might identify as non-binary.
The gender is nebulous.
The gender doesn't matter, because as someone playing the game, you imagine yourself as the character, and they want it to remain fluid and open so that anybody playing it identifies however they want to identify with the character. And they really like the idea that when you're a child, it sort of doesn't matter anyway. And the child is non-verbal in the game. They like the nebulousness of it.
Yeah.
It is not a character who identifies as non-binary, just to point out that.
That is a good distinction.
But a couple people have mentioned that the character looks like Sam and kind of walks like Sam with his limp because of the way they've designed the child's gait. Dove makes the comment that like, look, you want to sell this in Walmart, and I get the like artistic idea behind what you're doing, but you got to pick a gender, and you should pick boy because games with girls don't sell as well. And Sadie counters that like, your famous game, the reason I know you, has a girl as the main character. And he's like, yeah, but it didn't sell as well abroad. Or he has some dumb reason that it's some stupid fucking response. But then the people at Opus are just sort of like, oh, it looks like this guy here, Sam, in one of the meetings. They're like, so I guess it's a boy. All right, Ichigo's a boy.
And they assume that this is Sam's game and that Sam is the programmer.
In that meeting, yes, they do. And this is something that bothers Sadie a lot.
Sam, for what it's worth, the main guy from Opus, says to Sam, so you're the programmer. And Sam does immediately say, I am a programmer, but Sadie's the programmer.
Yes.
Very much giving her credit. And Sadie follows up with, we designed the game together.
this does,
but he does.
Sadie will never let go of.
This sets off exactly that something Sadie will never let go of, even though, like I said, that's why I like to point out that Sam's immediate response is, I'm a programmer. Sadie is the programmer. It makes it a point of like, she's the one who has done the majority of the work in that department. Like, he could not have done this without Sadie.
Correct. So they go back to Marx's apartment and they argue about this. And Sadie says some, in my opinion, thoughtless stuff about, if money's so important to you, Sam, why didn't you just go work for Bear Stearns like everybody else in your major? If money's so important to you, if it's such a big deal. And Sam reminds her that he did not grow up in Beverly fucking Hills. He's poor. He grew up behind a pizza place. Money is important to him.
And then he also has nothing to live on. They're not in college anymore. He has nothing to live on while they make another game if they go with Cellar
Door. After walking her home, and has something like $20,000 worth of medical bills from that experience.
Right.
And again, I like Sadie's character. I like that she is consistently thoughtless in this way. It is consistent with sort of the way she is written. I just like that she is allowed to be this person. And she, not for nothing, listens to this and yields and says, fine, let's go with Opus. Again, there is no internal reflection on any of this from the characters. They don't think this through in their heads. There's no point where Sadie thinks about what she said, reflects on it, and realizes that, like, oh, yeah, gosh, man, how could I not think of that? There's no point where Sam thinks to himself, how could she not know this? And I know how much something means to her. We don't get anything in their heads where they reflect on this. We just get their feeling, Sam wants this, she wants this.
Right.
They don't reflect on the interactions between one another. So they go with Opus. Sadie very much does not want to promote the game or do any of the on-the-road stuff. She does a couple of interviews and she doesn't like it. Sam, it turns out, really plays up a crowd well and is really good on stage and seems to find a confidence and an effusiveness and an outgoingness that does not exist for him in regular life when he is up on stage talking about the game that they have made. And this makes Sadie feel very diminished. It bums her out. It also bums her out that they have to make Ichigo 2 right away. They have to start on it. And Sam is around less for the development of Ichigo 2 than he was for the original game because he is on the road promoting the original Ichigo. She feels like she got stuck staying home taking care of the baby to some extent, right? Like, she gets stuck back in the office making Ichigo 2 with the developers from Opus who are meant to help her. And right. Sam is out around the world promoting the game and going to cons. And
because of that, it is being viewed as his game. There's very little talk of her because she's not an interesting female, because she's not linked to him in some way. They're not related. This isn't some like, oh, these two siblings made a game, or this husband and wife team made a game. The fact that they're not together and Sam turns out to be the one who is better at doing the marketing and playing up a crowd, it erases her from it a little bit.
Yes. It we are says, told Sam always makes sure to talk about her and to talk about her contributions. But because he is the face of the game, because he looks like the main character, because he is out there doing all of the legwork for this part of it, there is just a natural assumption on a lot of people's part that Sam Mazur made this game.
Right.
This is where the relationship starts to fall apart from
as
that
adults.
Yeah, from that honeymoon phase. Ichigo 2 comes out. It sells better than Ichigo. The reviews of it are, what would you say, fine? Like, they're a little bit critical where they're like, oh, it's more of the same. It's not different. It doesn't add anything, really. It's a good game. It's another good game, but it's not special.
It didn't take the Ichigo character in a new direction. It didn't push things graphically, technically, or story-wise.
Right. But it sells more than the first one. They're rich. It does really well. People do like it, but it doesn't have that magic of the first thing they made together, that incredible period where they were like holed up in Marx's apartment, banging out this incredible game. So they get in a fight and Sadie's like, I do not want to make Ichigo 3. I'm not making Ichigo 3. And Sam's like, well, what do you want to make? And she's like, I want to make a game called Both Sides. So, all right. Around this time, when they are fighting, when they are having problems, these problems, Sam's foot is getting worse and worse and worse. And we learn that it is an inevitability and has been for a while that he is sooner or later going to have it amputated. This is the foot that was injured in the car wreck that killed his mother. Why he was in the hospital in the first place when Sadie met him. So Marx isn't sure what to do about this. Marx thinks they should move out to California. He isn't sure how to get either one of them to do it. And his girlfriend, Zoe, tells him, oh, you're just not, just tell each one that they need to do it for the other one. And they will do it for the other one. They won't do it for themselves, but they'll do it for the other one. Tell Sam that we should go to California to get Sadie away from Dove. She can get out of this relationship. She can get out there. It'll be better for her. That's why we should go to California. It'll be better for Sadie. And Marx tells Sadie, we should go out to California where Sam can get his foot amputated. It's not like winter here like it is in Massachusetts where he has to walk around and deal with the snow and the ice everyone drives. It will be a far better rehabilitation process for him if we get him out to California. So then everybody wants to go to California and they move to LA. Sadie breaks up with Dove.
I do really love how she breaks up with him. It's very non-emotional. She's just moving and it's just like, yeah, I'm moving. And also we're out.
I love how emotional Dove gets about it though. We've been waiting for a little, because of the other breakup that they had, which was like all in Dove's court, right? Like the power was all with Dove in the other breakup. And then in this one, Sadie's just like, deuces, I'm out. I'll see you around.
Yeah.
Stop by the office if you're out in California. Like she's utterly cool about it.
Yeah. I love that. I do love it. He's like, very, Dove's, he takes her to the airport and he's just like, love you. And she's like, yeah, bye.
He's devastated. He's devastated.
Thanks for Ulysses. Bye. That is a real moment for me with Sadie of just being like, yeah, like I said, she definitely has
no, she gets her future without him in it. Like she's just like,
she and Sam are flawed characters. They are kind of unlikable characters a little bit, but they both have some very good points. Sam has a little bit more of not redemption arc, but he has a little more character growth than Sadie does.
He matured Sadie, that way.
But Sadie does have some
always coming from a more vulnerable point than Sadie is in the beginning of the book.
Like he's far more vulnerable. Yeah. Well, kind of only one bad thing ever happens to Sadie. And it's Mark's dying.
The Dove relationship is not great.
That is true.
It's not great for her mentally. I guess she does get some stuff out of it. She gets a career out of it.
She does get a career out of it. Yeah.
She gets Ulysses. She gets an equity partner and a producer who I know she's not fully satisfied with the way it goes, but Ichigo is a huge success. Yeah, she doesn't have. Yeah. As Sam is coming from a lower point, both economically, mentally, and physically. Yeah.
Something we haven't highlighted in terms of Sam's foot that I don't think we've talked about very much. One is the fact that, like, it is a disability.
He's in pain all the time.
He is struggling functionally.
Yes.
He is in incredible pain often throughout this book. And there is a low-lying pain for the majority of his life until more towards the end of the book when he gets a little bit more used to the amputation. And once he's more fully rehabbed from like the amputation and the use of a prosthetic and stuff. And then as a young person to have always had that. He's 12 or 13 when the accident initially happened. So to spend those tender years where you're changing so much and you have this disability, it's a real hell of a thing for a young person to be dealing with.
I think he might be, is Sadie a year older than him?
I think he's a year older than Sadie. I think they're in the same grade because I think he has to repeat a year because of the accident. He has to repeat a year because of the accident. So he's...
And you bought mitzvah.
So I guess you bought at 12. So he'd have been 11 or 12.
You bar at 13. So he would have been 13.
Oh, 13. It is 13. You're right.
You're right. I think you're right. You bought mitzvah at 12. You bar mitzvah if you're a boy at 13, I think. I think the girls do it a year earlier.
You might be right.
He would be 13. Also bar mitzvah age. And she would be 12 when they meet bat mitzvah age, I believe.
They're a year apart and they'll get put in the same grade.
I think we're in part 4 now of the book where all of the shit starts to pile up.
Yeah.
So everyone's in California. Sadie breaks up with Dove. Sam signs up for the surgery to have his foot amputated, and they get an office. The morning of Sam's surgery, she talks to him on the phone. She is unpacking her new office, and she sees a copy of Dead Seas as she's unpacking her stuff in the new space. And she opens it, and she sees on the copy of Dead Seas, her copy, where Dove wrote a note to her on the disc.
I have it. It says, to Sadie on her 20th, the sexiest, most brilliant girl in advanced games, love DM.
Love DM. Okay. So she sees this note. She'd forgotten that it was there. And she starts remembering in her head, and she determines that Sam, when he was playing that game of her game and asked her to go get Ulysses, must have seen that note, realized that she had a relationship with Dove, and then pushed her to go to her ex-boyfriend to get the graphics engine because he just wanted the game to be done and wanted the best engine and did not care about her or her feelings and was willing to have her go back through all this stuff again, the second part of the relationship, in order to get Ulysses for Ichigo. And she sees this as an outright total betrayal and hates Sam. This all happens in like 5 minutes. Hates Sam. Immediately is angry and furious with him.
She's looking for a reason to be angry and furious because she's feeling resentful about Ichigo. So like this thing happens and it opens up this like wound of, yes, now I have this concrete thing where I can hate him.
Yes, I think that's the correct, that's the reading that I took of it. And I think that's the correct reading, that she's mad and it's simmering just below the surface. And she's got these things that she's been upset with, starting with Marx is getting a producer credit. No one talked about that with me. Marx is back in the apartment and that's apparently cool. No one talked about that with me. Oh, I'm dating Dove again. I don't like that. I have to do S&M. I don't care for S&M. This is stupid. Suddenly Ichigo's a boy instead of an ambiguous gender of childhood. Suddenly everybody thinks it's Sam's game. Like all of these things have been festering and simmering. And she sees this and is just like, Sam is a manipulative piece of shit. Okay. So instead of, they don't do Ichigo 3. Sadie builds her own game engine now. Called Oneric, and she builds it for the game that she wants them to make called Both Sides. And Both Sides is, what is it? You play in two worlds. One is like this haunted, like creepy world, and the other one is like a suburb.
Yeah.
So she builds Oneric. She calls Dove about it and just they chit chat because they're still friends. Like we just got that whole part about like how angry she is at Sam for betraying her by putting her back in Dove's path. And then in this part, she calls him just to be like, hey, I built a graphics engine.
Right.
Just because I guess they call and catch up with
I will point out that I noticed as I was flipping through is that when she's trying to leave him, when she's leaving for LA and Dove is like mad about it, he does like handcuff her to the bed as like punishment.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
so I'm not. That. But yeah, it's like it feels like she doesn't want to take accountability and ownership of her own poor decision to be with Dove.
No.
And she puts that on Sam. And we find out later when she's initially upset about that first breakup with Dove, it's not just that.
Hang on, put a pin in
that. It's not
just
that, and we'll come back to that. But again, I feel like you're angry at Sam because you don't want to take accountability. You could have also just been like, no, I'm not going to this guy. Fuck this guy. This guy's a terrible guy and I'm not going to go to him.
I feel like the Dove relationship warrants some discussion because it lasts throughout the book on the face.
But to your point, she calls him just to talk to him about Oneric.
And the Dove relationship plays a central part in her anger towards Sam. That is... what is it? It's not untrue, but it is not Sam's fault she got back with Dove. And the argument that Sam saw that and was like, I don't care about her feelings. I just want Ulysses is a stretch.
Noticing personal details does not seem to be Sam's strength. I don't feel like Sam would take this disc out of there, read it, and stick it into a machine. Sam doesn't seem real.
No,
Sam understands that somebody he knows is super... I keep going back to this. Sam understands that someone he knows is super depressed, like when he wants to talk to Sadie about making the game, And he has to talk to Mark to be like, well, what do you do when somebody's sad? See, Sam isn't someone who understands interpersonal relationship tales.
When they finally have it, though. Oh, he doesn't. When they finally have it out, he does not deny that he saw the note, though. Like when she says it, his response is, so what if I saw it?
We find out later that he probably didn't through Mark.
Well, he doesn't deny it. When she tells him, he just says, so what if I knew?
Well, sure. Yeah, that's true.
And we don't get anything internal from them about it. I think some of the withholding of internal rumination on their relationship and stuff like that is meant to leave this ambiguous for us, the reader, because this is interesting. We don't have Sam saying to himself, I would have never, or anything like that. We are left just with Sam's answer. Well, so what if I saw it? We are left to hash out, if Sam saw it, does he know who DM is? Does he read the way that note is phrased and be like, oh, they had a relationship? Does he put all that together?
We do also have that quote where, like, they don't talk about stuff like this.
That's also true.
They have privacy. So for him, it's like, this girl's depressed. I guess he could go from like, oh, she said she had a boyfriend at one point, and then she did.
He doesn't. She never tells him that I'm depressed because I was broke up with. And also.
Right.
Let's get to that in a minute. Should we get to it?
No, we'll get to it. We'll get back to the plot for the moment. But no, she's extrapolating without any proof. You're mad and you're angry. And now you have found this one little detail that lets you extrapolate this whole other thing.
That's what it feels like. So she calls Dove to chit chat about an Eric. They're still friends. They have a conversation. Sadie's dating a guy named Abe from a band. Sam has had his surgery and his stump hurts terribly all the time. He's not doing great with it. Lola, a former girlfriend of Sam's from high school that we've never heard of, shows up and they hook up and she gets him high. And I guess that's where Sam starts smoking weed. And then Lola.
He's notoriously been a bit of a
teetotaler. And then Lola exits the novel forever.
I mean, she's mentioned again that he has a girlfriend or something, but yeah, that really is it for Lola. I didn't even remember her name because she's not in it long enough for it to matter.
No. No, she's not in it long enough for matter. It feels like she's in it so that they can just kind of say, like, Sam has had four lovers. It was two girls and two boys. I don't know. None of that really adds up to anything except maybe to give us a little bit of a basis to think that Sam had a life outside of Sadie. That Sam is out there getting into some kind of relationships and physical relationships with people.
Well, and I think it also highlights that, like, they're not close.
Yeah, I guess that, like,
they're not close friends. For them, for people to call this like a love story between Sam and Sadie, they don't like each other for most of the book.
Okay, yeah, that's like
they're only friends during Ichigo.
Yeah, all of the reviews I was reading that were just like, oh, the connection between these two people. And I'm like, these are business partners.
These are business partners that don't like each other and aren't friends for most of the book, but they have a long history.
No, there's a point in it where she's just sort of like, I love you, Sam. But like, she's from California. People out there just say that shit to anybody. Like, that's it's a very LA thing. They don't mean it. They are business partners who have to get along sometimes in good times and bad times. So they finish both sides and reviews are mixed. Some people like it, some people don't. It is not the hit Ichigo was. It's not hated, it's not reviled, but the reviews are not uniformly positive. They're mixed. It takes a lot of criticism. Sadie takes this very hard. So we come to a chapter. We come to two chapters, 5A and 5B. The only two, I think, that are labeled this way. So in chapters 5A and 5B, Sadie and Sam have it out, where Sam goes over to her apartment. She lets him in. And he's like, why do you hate me all of a sudden? Why don't you like me? What is going on with you? And it comes, so she tells him finally, you saw Dead Seas and you saw Dove's note and you didn't care about me. You just wanted to get Ulysses from Dove and that's all you cared about. And the argument goes into other things too, where like Sam talks about what a terrible year he has had, having his foot cut off. Sadie disparages his work on the promotional tours and he takes that personally. He's like, it just seems like you can't admit that this is something that is hard to do, something that you can't do, something that I'm good at and that does actually take effort and work. And you seem to only see it in light of me trying to steal credit for a thing that I'm not really trying to steal credit for. They argue about all of this. When Sadie mentions the thing about the note on the CD, on the disc, Sam says, you know, so what if I saw it? He doesn't deny, though, that it's a little bit frustrating. He doesn't say, like, of course, Sadie, I did not want you to get back with Dove.
She says, did you ever ask yourself why I was depressed? He said, I thought you'd broken up with your boyfriend. That's what your roommate said, I think. I didn't know it was Dove.
Yeah, okay. I'm kind of with Sam on this. I don't know why. If Sam saw that note on the disc, I don't think he would have immediately been like, oh, that's, she's had a relationship with this guy.
Right.
And you're sad.
And it's DM. And it could be some dude that was in advanced games with her.
Yes.
Whose initials are also DM.
Yeah.
But she says, yet. You didn't know yet. But yes, it was Dove. But that's not the reason I was depressed. Everyone thinks Ichigo is about you, but it's really about me. What do you mean? Ichigo is about a boy who has been lost at sea, but it's also about a mother who has lost her child. I never had a child, but I might have. She turned away from him. She hadn't told anyone about the abortion. Not Dove, not Alice, not Frida. And even now, she struggled to say the word to Sam.
So there's a couple things about this. One, I do think it is clever to have the reason that she was in bed not be what we assumed as the reader, that it was just like, oh, she actually took the relationship, the breakup with Dove worse than we thought. Because we had read the line where she's like, where she was already imagining a future without Dove, and then her and Dove break up, and then she's in bed for 12 days. Reading it, I was just sort of like, oh, I guess she took that harder than she anticipated taking it. But it turns out that that's not why she was in bed. It was because of this abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Never comes up again in the novel.
She says, I felt so ashamed, and maybe that's why I let him do the things he did. And this makes Sam feel bad of, why didn't you ever tell me that? And this is where she gets mad about that, this little arrangement where they don't talk to each other. Where she says, because we never say anything real to each other. We play games and we talk about games and we talk about making games and we don't know each other at all.
Yeah. And I think that's accurate.
I think that is accurate. It is an accurate description of this book.
I think it's clever that the reason that she was in bed is not the thing that we assumed. I think it's a little cheap to just be like, ah, turns out it was an abortion. Anyway, moving on.
The thing of, I was ashamed and that's why I let him do the things he did. That is a very legitimate reason, I think, for a woman to stay in a relationship is to feel really like ashamed and to then just let the guy punish her for it a little bit, I think is like a real, is a real thing. So I think that does describe a little bit like why she ends up staying with Dove. That's a little bit a part of the power of like, I deserve this. I don't deserve to be with somebody better or deserve to be with somebody who's like kind of shitty and masochistic to me because I did this thing. But Sam's response to this is to be empathetic and kind towards Sadie of like, I'm sorry, I didn't know this.
Yeah, it is. Because here's the thing.
It doesn't come up again. And it is also a thing where it's like, if you guys talked about something real and this was something he'd known, he wouldn't have asked you to go back to Dove.
Well, and they don't start talking about things that are real.
This doesn't change their...
Yeah, this confrontation.
Relationship. And it
the
doesn't
abortion,
make
the revelation, the talk about how much pain he's been in. This one little raw chapter never influences them for the rest of the book.
Right. It doesn't change their relationship. She doesn't have any forgiveness.
No,
it doesn't soften any of her anger towards Sam at all. For Sam to just be like, I'm so sorry, and have this like empathetic response to that. And for her, it's like, does this not unravel? Like, do you think he would have asked you to go to Dove if he had known that? Like, that's on you for not telling him.
Yes.
You're angry at him. You're angry at him. And it's like, I don't know. His response in this conversation makes it seem like this isn't something he'd have asked of you if you two had a real friendship, he wouldn't have asked this of you.
A lot comes out of this conversation that just does not. And I don't need the rest of the book to be about it. But if you're going to tell us all of this stuff and reveal the abortion, it seems like it should at least have some influence on the character's behavior or impact something further down the line in the plot, right?
Yes, for it to be this like sort of bomb drop reveal in here. And then for them to have this kind of conversation and then it not to ever go anywhere or to change the dynamic or to come back up again is, then what's the point of this?
Yeah, it's not even like they argue about it again. Like they don't talk about it again or even have another fight about it.
Right. It doesn't change her relationship. It doesn't change her relationship with him or how she feels about him. She just continues to be angry and not like him for the rest of this book.
Yeah. And I think that's a little I think I mentioned this is a very Gen X novel. It's just like, you bottle up your feelings, you shove them down. It doesn't matter. We're not going to dwell in our trauma. We're not going to keep coming, talking about it or marinate in it or anything like that, which I think is deliberate within the book. And this is my other critique. I have two. The ending we'll get to. But this, I feel like, should inform at least one thing later on in the book. Because we get this whole thing with Ant and Simon. And I don't know, like their lifestyle, they're gay. Their lifestyle stuff that ends up being like a, what is it? Like the butterfly flaps its wing in a country and a bomb goes off another.
Yeah, it ends up being the butterfly effect. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like that kind of drives like this like terrible thing that happens in the second half of the novel that we're going to get to, which is fine. It just seems like it seems like a second book starts right now and we don't finish up with the emotional reveal from the first book, which we just got in chapters 5A and 5B from part
four. Correct.
So they have this big fight and then they smoke some pot. And then that chapter ends with them smoking pot.
Hello, everybody. This is Kennedy Weibel from Reading Pop Classics, breaking in here at the end of the episode. We had a lot to say about Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, so much so that we ended up having to break the episode into two parts. So this is going to conclude part one. And if you give me a couple of days, part two will be up where we will conclude Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and do our usual end of episode games, including the casting call, the quotes, who do you remind me of, and so forth. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for your continued patronage, all of the communication that you send us and the emails, following us on Instagram and so forth. And we look forward to seeing you on the next episode, part two of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow.